Hi, welcome to this week's program. The major stock indexes continue to climb to record highs, and there's one notable individual who isn't on board the train to ever higher stock prices. Care to guess about whom I might be speaking? By the way, I'm watching The Crown, so my English is getting much better. It's Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha. Yes, I said Warren Buffett. Even as Berkshire Hathaway once again beat analysts' predictions with its most recent quarterly report, Buffett's conglomerate was steadily pulling money out of the stock market, increasing its cash position. In fact, over the past 6 years, since 2013, Berkshire Hathaway has increased its cash balance by more than 400%, from around $30 billion to nearly $130 billion. All the way up on this record bull run, Buffett has been piling up cash and relentlessly reducing his exposure to stocks. So, what could be the reason for Buffett's massive move toward cash and away from the market? Well, you may recall one of the most frequently quoted Buffett adages about stock trading, and that is, be fearful when others are greedy, and greedy when others are fearful. Buffett's move to more cash caught the attention of Wall Street when a long-term Berkshire Hathaway investor just earlier this year sold his entire holdings in Berkshire, moving his money into other stocks while expressing his frustration with Buffett's cautionary stance in the market. And that investor is not alone in his criticism of Buffett. CNBC recently noted that a number of stock market analysts, many of whom no doubt continue urging investors to buy with both hands, have questioned why Buffett is increasingly moving to the sidelines. This Buffett bashing is one market trend that sets off alarm bells for me and one analyst, Gary Evans. Gary is the editor of Global Macro Monitor, and he's pulled no punches in a recent column referring to those questioning Buffett's market wisdom as idiots, writing, "The idiots have a gall to mock this man for holding so much cash." He reminded readers of the last time Buffett refused the temptation to invest more in a surging bull market. 1999, right before the dot-com bubble burst in 2000. And that was a bubble burst that Buffett clearly predicted in a letter to Berkshire Hathaway investors in early 2000. Evans also offered some technical analysis that supports Buffett's market position. One market indicator that Buffett thinks is probably the best single measure of the value of the market at any given moment is the ratio calculated by dividing the value of the entire U.S. stock market by our entire gross domestic product. Any ratio over 115% indicates a significantly overvalued market. And today, this ratio stands at 147%, which is even higher than it was during the dot-com bubble. Still, some investors may object, pointing out that the stock market has simply continued to hit one record high after another in 2019. Doesn't that prove that Buffett's cautionary move to cash is wrong? Well, no. All it shows is that Buffett's current analysis of the market hasn't been proven right just yet. One might be interested to learn that those investors who have correctly predicted a major market crash were often a bit early in their predictions. Two major investors who not only avoided getting hurt by and actually made huge profits from the stock market crash of 1929 were Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., father of President John F. Kennedy, and the legendary stock trader Jesse Livermore. Both men first began moving from being long stocks to being short stocks during the late 1928 to early 1929 period. As things turned out, they were a bit early with their market caution, but it nonetheless paid off hugely when the crash occurred in October of 1929. There's even a funny story around Jesse Livermore's experience during the crash. While Jesse was working in his Manhattan office on Black Monday, October 28th, his wife heard the news of the stock market crash on the radio at home. Fearing that her husband had been wiped out like so many other investors, she gathered up her jewelry for Jesse to pawn if need be, and moved herself and the children from the main house into a much less expensive-to-maintain guest cottage. When Livermore came home and eventually found his family huddled together in the guest quarters, His wife explained her actions during the day and calmly offered her husband her jewelry box. Livermore then informed his wife that he had sold stock short on a massive scale and that his profits for the day totaled approximately $2 million. That's $30 million in today's money. I think the point here is that Buffett is not only selling off stocks, but he is not investing new cash into the market as well. So as the market rises, he'll probably earn less than he would if he were fully invested. For many investment managers, this would be a bad thing because their investors want their managers to beat the market. If a manager can't beat the market, it makes more sense to buy an index fund, right? Buffett doesn't care, however, because he isn't catering to investors' whims and fears. He wants to make sure that over the next 50 to 100 years, he has protected his shareholders' money and will be positioned to swoop up companies when things inevitably turn down. Investing in Berkshire, therefore, is probably a safe way to get market-like returns, but with a large margin of safety when things go wrong. Now, no one has a crystal ball, so no one knows what the future holds for stocks. Everyone is a guesser when it comes to the stock market, but I think Warren Buffett has adequately proven that he's generally a better guesser when it comes to the stock market than most of us. Of course, it's perfectly fine to have a different opinion than his, but I don't think I'd go so far as to be mocking Warren Buffett's market analysis. That's just not something that's likely to end up with you looking like the smart one. As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, no T, stevepomerantz.com, and contact us one more time, stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. My next guest is Mike Offit. He was a senior trader for commercial mortgages and asset-backed securities at Goldman Sachs and founded and ran the commercial mortgage and real estate department for industry leader Deutsche Bank. In April 2007, he wrote an article that warned that the problems at Bear Stearns were the beginning of a massive bank crisis. Shortly thereafter, he wrote a piece that predicted the failure of the brokerage and banking system and advised investors to get their money into safe custody banks. And he was dead on all of this. I want to ask him to talk about his new book, Nothing Personal, A Novel of Wall Street. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks very much. I'm very happy to be here.
You think of your book as a bit of a parable, a coming-of-age story wrapped in a white-collar crime novel. And you've had all these years living in the center of the vortex of the big trading desks on Wall Street. So tell us the story.
Well, the novel was obviously inspired by my years on the street and running a couple of big trading desks at Goldman and Deutsche Bank, and I also spent years at First Boston. And I was inspired to write a story that reflected my experience, but also would hopefully be something of an educational book for readers where they could get a sense of what this inside world of the big, powerful investment banks really was like, and also the effect that it would have and does have on young people who go into that business. So in doing that, I was inspired to sort of carry the narrative with a white-collar crime story and a murder mystery, because those things, you know, always do tend to come together. You know, if you look at the sort of the four main themes in people's lives and also in literature, there is, you know, romance and family, money, power, and spirituality and morality. So I tried to bring all of that together into an effective narrative that, after having read it, hopefully the reader would be entertained and also have learned something and gotten something of a flavor for how all of this comes together and why we see on Wall Street these cycles of boom and bust.
Yeah.
And really, that does lead into sort of, you know, an analysis of the financial system and these cyclical crises that we go through.
Well, let's get into that. I don't know if you've seen The Wolf of Wall Street.
I have, yeah.
You have, yeah. And I know I ask that question to a lot of people. They have not yet seen it. It's definitely something that is way over the top, something you do want to see. But to the degree that it's really just all about, you know, how much money you can make at any cost to the end client. When you were managing these trading desks and you were putting together packages of mortgages, you know, for the most part, were these good investments? Were half of them, you know, bad investments? What was the general thinking about the investments themselves?
Well, you know, sort of fortunately and also unfortunately, I'm old enough that when I started doing this, originally the mortgage-backed securities business was relatively new. So I was there for the creation of sort of the first structured mortgage securities.
You're talking about Ginnie Mae's,
Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, yeah. Single families, those were the earliest.
Right.
But then Wall Street started to figure out ways to package and structure those into bonds.
CMOs,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, interestingly enough, that first mortgage-backed security structured, the CMO, had its crisis in late 1986 into 1987, where those bonds suffered enormous losses because interest rates dropped and refinancings really accelerated. And this affected bonds in those securities that were very sensitive to prepayments. So even the first structured mortgage-backed security had its, you know, cycle of boom and then a gigantic bust.
And folks, the idea here is that if you're packaging a bunch of mortgages and you're looking at the cash flow that's being paid to you as a bondholder, part of that has to do with the number of people that are actually either refinancing, so you're getting your money back, or moving, you're getting your money back because they're paying off their mortgages. So the rate at which you get your money back really determines your overall rate of return.
Exactly. With mortgages in particular, their sensitivity to interest rates is heightened because, in effect, if you go and invest your money, say, at one time you could buy 9 or 10% mortgage-backed securities, you didn't control how long you could hold that bond.
Mm-hmm.
If the owners of the, say, 10,000 individual single-family homes in that pool of mortgages that you bought all went out and refinanced, your bond would get paid off. Instead of in 30 years, it could be in a month or 2 months very quickly. So mortgages had sort of a typical bond structure of a sensitivity to interest rates, but it was really magnified by the fact that there was no call protection, is the technical word for it. They could be taken away from you at any time.
And I guess one of the problems with the Wall Street firms is they were trading these, they were holding on to them in inventory, and they were using just excessive amounts of borrowed capital or leverage to do it with.
Exactly. This really began during my career in the mid to late 80s, where firms began to hold big proprietary trading positions. Sometimes it was voluntary because, you know, you decided that they were cheap and you wanted to hold on to them. Sometimes it was involuntary because you just couldn't sell them to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And in 86, 87, it was more of the involuntary type. It was they couldn't sell them and built up these big inventories. So we've seen a cycle of this on the street. There was the 86, 87 mortgage bust. And then shortly after that, we had the savings and loan crisis, which was also in large part fueled by commercial real estate lending.
Yeah.
The savings and loan industry suddenly had access to a vast amount of capital, and because they were given federal insurance for their deposits. So as people put their money into these banks, completely protected by the federal government, the banks had a lot of money they needed to invest very quickly. And one of the things they did was they lent aggressively to commercial developers who put up buildings that wound up being empty. They defaulted. The bank started to lose an awful lot of money, and then we had the S&L crisis and bailout in the late 1980s.
Yeah, the government had to come in and bail them out just like they did in 08.
Right. A little bit different in that they actually let them fail,
mm-hmm.
and they took over all of these assets
and then sold
them off at a deep discount to, guess who, Wall Street, the very same entities that had helped these banks grow and cause the problem to begin with.
Where does that put us when we get up to 2007? Describe very quickly the state of the world that you saw before the bust began.
Right. Well, I retired in 1998, 99 after another crisis, which was the long-term capital management crisis,
yeah,
where a big hedge fund failed, and it was operating on 40 or 50 to 1 leverage numbers. So Wall Street was lending it $50 for every dollar of capital that it had. So it controlled these enormous positions, and there was an Asian banking crisis followed by Russia defaulting, and suddenly this huge hedge fund had losses and needed to sell these securities to meet margin calls. And there wasn't that good a market for them. They were very leveraged and toxic securities to begin with. And as they began to sell them off, the prices declined, and then other hedge funds had to meet margin calls, and it snowballed into a big liquidity crisis. Not quite on the scale of 2008, but enormous enough that the Fed had to intervene. And had they not intervened in 1998, Lehman Brothers likely would have failed because they had a huge exposure to this hedge fund. So at that time, the regulators assured everybody that this would never happen again. Mm-hmm. They would carefully control leverage. And in 2003, there was another sort of issue that came up where Congress got involved, was that all of the big insurance companies that backed larger accounts at brokerage firms stopped offering, it was called excess SIPC insurance.
I remember that.
For people with larger accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they left the market was they said that the investment banks, the brokerage firms' balance sheets, had gotten so big and complex that even these sophisticated insurance companies like Travelers, and AXA, and Radiant, they couldn't understand Wall Street balance sheets. So if they were going to insure them against failure, they needed to really understand what those risks were, and they couldn't.
So for once, the insurance companies got something right.
They got that one dead right.
Yeah.
I mean, dead right.
Yeah.
And so they left. So the brokerage industry was left with this sort of image crisis. If these big, sophisticated third-party insurance companies said that they were taking too much risk, what could they possibly do? And the General Accounting Office in Congress got very stern with them and said, you need to solve this problem. And they sort of went to a very unique solution, which was 14 of the biggest brokerage firms quickly formed a captive insurance company to offer this excess SIPC insurance. The problem with it was they put it in the beautiful state of Vermont, not New York or Washington, D.C., but in a remote state, because that state didn't require any financial disclosure at all for that insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
And I got concerned about that in 2006, 2007. I said, gee, if you have an account at a brokerage firm, you've got the SIPC insuring up to $500,000 of your money, and this excess SIPC coming from this company that we don't know anything about. And SIPC itself only had about $1 billion in capital and was insuring trillions of dollars of brokerage accounts. And this excess SIPC insurer had maybe no money or maybe $100 million. So that led me to be very concerned about the brokerage industry at that moment. And then there was a crisis in two Bear Stearns hedge funds, and it was very similar to what had happened with long-term capital management. They had bought with enormous leverage complicated mortgage-backed securities, and those had begun, the subprime mortgages, had begun to underperform. And there's sort of an irony in this, in that these things were called subprime mortgages for a reason. Their borrowers were people who couldn't get normal mortgages. They were risky borrowers.
But the way the brokerage firms were doing the math then, they were looking at historic rates of default and modeling that out so they could kind of get a sense for, how to price it with this idea that a certain amount would not work out. So,
exactly.
Right?
So they would structure a security where the lower rated classes would absorb all of the first losses.
Yeah.
And then the very top of what we call the capital structure, the best bonds would have this protection. And those bonds could be rated AAA, even if all of the underlying loans were really third-rate quality.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done together with the rating agencies. And in my career, I spent an awful lot of time with the rating agencies, always trying to convince them to be more flexible and give us, more AAA bonds on every deal that we did, because mm-hmm. that would make us more money.
So it's like alchemy. How do you take, a base metal and turn it into gold?
Fool's Gold is really the right mm-hmm. name, and it could be the name of another novel.
I remember doing a show or a segment on my show where I actually went in and looked at the balance sheet of these brokerage firms, and I saw a leverage of 33 to 1.
Yeah, and that's what you could see. I can tell you, when I was at Deutsche Bank, for example, in 1998, we had hit sort of our capital limits, so we couldn't grow our trading position anymore, and we really wanted to. We were very profitable, and my boss wanted us to, and the clever fellows down in the financing desk figured out a way to get us billions of dollars more leverage by issuing through an offshore lending conduit. So this wouldn't go on the balance sheet of the bank. It would sort of be, disappearing money that didn't didn't show up anywhere. So our leverage numbers were actually much greater than what was reported. It was perfectly legal. It was within the regulations. But even the numbers that you see when you look at the reports that are issued don't really give you the full picture.
What happens to your money if you have $100 and your leverage, you've only put down 3%, so your leverage is 33 times? What happens if that $100 loses a dollar?
Well, generally, you're hit with what's called a margin call. And that means your broker or your lender asks you to put up that dollar so that you maintain that 3% cushion. And of course, if you can't meet that margin call, they have the right to start liquidating bonds.
And they do liquidate.
Oh, they certainly do liquidate.
They don't care what your financial situation is. That money is going to get liquidated by 2 o'clock if you don't come in with
exactly.
The money.
Mm-hmm. It's very strict. And yeah. In fact, I had a consulting client a few years ago who had a margin call and had several hundred millions of dollars of municipal bonds liquidated into the market.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give him any time. And this was a billionaire. A big hitter, as the saying goes. Mm-hmm. So it's very strict, and it's very carefully enforced. But interestingly, within the firms themselves and lending to each other, the rules are a little bit more flexible, and how it's enforced is more flexible. But this became a huge area of concern for me in 2007. I saw these Bear Stearns hedge funds looking leveraged on, teetering on the brink of insolvency. Bear Stearns was forced by the rest of the industry to lend these two hedge funds $3 or $4 billion to keep them afloat, but it was, a flea in a tornado.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to stop it there. My guest is Mike Offit, his book, Nothing Personal, A Novel of Wall Street. Mike, thank you so much for joining us. I'd love to have you back sometime.
Okay. My website is www.mikeoffit.com, and this book is not a highly technical, difficult read. It is a lifelong dream that's been met, and I hope everybody enjoys reading it.
The last name is spelled Offit. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So I'm starting to use Airbnb more. I'm a really late adopter, okay? Because I know it's been around a long time. Actually, we went to Charleston.
Nice.
And we stayed in Airbnb, and it was not a pleasant experience.
Ooh.
Actually, we once went to Boulder and stayed in Airbnb, and it was not a pleasant experience. But we're doing it. We're at a family reunion in Asheville next year, and I think this should work out pretty well.
Oh, you got
me
scared, because I'm just going Airbnb for my daughter's wedding in Newport, Rhode Island.
You know, I like hotels. You know, I like everything kind of set up and protected and all that stuff. There's too many unknowns with an Airbnb. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about. What states in our beloved country have the most Airbnbs?
You already know the answer before you ask the question. Florida hits every category. No matter what the category is, Florida's going to be
We're a vanguard. States. We're ahead of the game.
We're always ahead of the game. Yeah. So believe it or not, Florida is number one.
Yeah. What areas, what cities in Florida are the most?
It actually kind of surprised me. Miami Beach.
I thought they had strict rules there.
I thought so too, but apparently not. Or at least, when they hear this on the radio, they're going to find out that they have a bunch of Airbnbs that they weren't aware of going on. I kind of thought that they would be real strict about it. Kissimmee, which is where Mickey Mouse lives.
Yeah, so Walt Disney World gets over 50 million visitors per year.
I think that'd be a good place to invest.
Yeah. And so Kissimmee, you say Kissimmee? I say Kissimmee.
Kissimmee. Yeah. Why Kissimmee? Is it an Indian?
It's Indian, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, they have the most Airbnbs in the state. I mean, they're one of the three.
Right. Yeah, Orlando, Miami, Sarasota.
Sarasota. Okay. That's interesting. So they measure this by the number of listings, the Airbnb to resident ratio.
Right.
Is what they call it. So there's some math there. Also, Florida's Daytona Beach and North Carolina's Asheville. As I said, we're...
Those for the leaf, what do you call them, leaf peakers?
The leaf
they
peakers.
They go up there
really.
In the fall.
Yeah. Yeah. We're actually doing it in June. Fort Lauderdale as well. So it's all in the, these are all in the top 10. So I have a question for you. Let's say that I have put my property up as an Airbnb.
Okay.
And I have done it in a state which allows recreational marijuana use.
Okay.
Should I be allowed to refuse that use on my property?
I'm going to say yes to that for the very simple reason, as a landlord myself, I refuse to allow people to smoke cigarettes.
Yeah.
And I don't even think it says cigarettes. At least it says smoking. So cigars would fall under that category.
Yeah.
Marijuana.
I think it's a trick question because the question is, it is legal in the state.
And so is smoking cigarettes.
That's my point.
And
anyway.
Cigars.
Okay. But as a homeowner, I would reserve the right to say no smoking in my house.
No smoky.
No smoking of any kind.
And actually, in the lease that I have, I'll allow you to smoke out on the patio.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just would say no.
Okay. All right. Changing subjects here. You remember the book and the movie, The Big Short?
Yes.
Okay. So this is about a bunch of hedge fund guys, basically, who decided that the real estate market was getting crazy in the 2000s.
Okay.
And they figured out a way to bet against mortgages with the idea by selling them.
Right.
And selling something they don't own. So
they shorted them.
They shorted them. So that means that when it came time to deliver, they were delivering some borrowed mortgages. And then at some point, they'd have to go into the market and buy those mortgages to close out the transaction. So the thought is they're buying those mortgages at a lower price than what they sold. That's what's
right.
Shorting. So you make money when the asset goes down in price.
Right, okay. Right. You're selling them in advance and you're buying them cheaper.
That's exactly right. So the Big Short was this huge amount of risk that these few individuals took. And they went through a very tough time because the market was frothy. The market was hypnotically in a bubble, thinking that real estate prices were going up forever. And these guys were wrong for a really long period of time. When you're wrong going short, it really hurts.
Yeah.
And I won't go into why, but it really does. Timing is incredibly important when you short something. Well, as we all know, the tide turned.
Right.
The shift happened. And these guys made a ton of money and they became very famous. Someone wrote a book and they made a movie. Point of all this is that one of those Big Short investors is now betting against mortgages again.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of scary, right?
It is.
If these guys, that doesn't mean they're going to be right. But it's a little bit different this time around. Last time it was because the housing market was overpriced and crazy and people who shouldn't have been buying homes were
exactly.
buying homes. This time it's not that. It's all about climate change.
Right.
It's all about the idea that you have these properties that are susceptible to water, I guess, flooding.
Right. Florida.
Florida would be a good example. California.
Texas.
Okay. And the pricing of the mortgages and the homes, it's not priced in. These homes, the mortgages are too big relative to the
risk. Yep.
So this is interesting. So I live in Delray Beach.
Right.
And I do not experience any flooding whatsoever in my community.
You're on an island.
No, I'm not on an island. I'm just in a community that has a lot of lakes.
Right.
And I'm like,
so it's controlled
I'm 8
flooding.
To 10 feet above the lake.
Right.
And I guess you could say I'm kind of at a high point, I guess, inside. I don't know. But it doesn't feel like a high point.
Exactly.
In Florida.
High point in Florida.
Yeah, and 8 feet is a high point in Florida. So I don't personally experience it, but I know that when I was looking for a place in 2013, I was looking heavily on the beach.
Sure.
And I saw what was going on there. And I said to myself, you know, I think this is only going to get worse. Why would I want to own property there? But people are.
Yeah. And you're not the first person to say that to me. As a matter of fact, I've got a client right now who's very specific. We had to pull out the floodplain maps and show him, you know, where the flood zones were because he's adamant that he does not and will not purchase a property if it's in a flood zone.
Well, he's being kind of smart about that.
I guess no one else ever brings this.
Yeah. Well, that's the, I think you're going to start hearing about
we're
that more.
We're going to hear a little bit more of it. And you know, one of the things just noting, you know, driving down A1A the other day, we have what's called the King High Tide right now. And I can't explain it anything more than this time of year, are very high.
Mm-hmm.
And driving along A1A, there's water on the road that is coming from the intercoastal.
From the intercoastal.
Oh. You can see the water coming above the seawall and into the middle of the road. And now I'm driving my car through this salt water.
Yeah.
Now, it's not real deep. I mean, it's just
No, but it's going to get up on
But over
underneath.
Time, yeah. So I can see, I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think of Venice.
Yeah. This particular individual is basically saying that he's betting because we're in a period of time of climate change denial. So things are not being priced correctly, and that's where he's expecting to make his money. Unfortunately, we are out of time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. The path to success is rarely easy or direct, and so many who have reached considerable heights have begun their lives in challenging conditions. Some lived in their car on $2.50 a day. Others were terrified of public speaking, or another's brother committed suicide at age 23 when he was only 21. This new book by Jillian Zoe Siegel brings to light the human side of their success and gives us all some insight into how each of them succeeded at getting there. And that's the name of her book, Getting There, A Book of Mentors. Let's welcome Jillian to our show. Hi, Jillian. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So it's a wonderful book. I recommend it to my listeners. The pictures are beautiful and the stories are very, very human. Depictions of what these people went through to reach their success. Let's start out with some of your favorites. Tell us the story about one of your favorite interviews.
Well, I think you cannot have Warren Buffett in your book and not have him as your favorite. He's just such an incredible person. So when somebody asks me that question, I always just think of him. He's someone who's really where he is because he deserves it. And the more time you spend with him, the more you realize that. I think people, a lot of times people want to chip away at him or find a little chink in his armor, but I haven't found one yet.
When you say deserve it, what do you mean?
Well, he is a wealth of money and a wealth of wisdom. You know, he taught me so many things, and I think you can't meet him and not have it change your life in a way. And he also is such an incredible communicator. That the way he phrases things, even if you might have heard something similar before, it really sort of hits home in a way that it doesn't if somebody else said it.
It's almost like a musical talent, even though he swears he has no musical talent whatsoever.
Yes.
But the way he phrases things, it's true. He seems to get everything just, he nails them on the head. What are some of the things that he said during your interview that you wrote in the book that really has stuck with you?
Well, one of the things that he told me, he taught me that you can always tell someone to go to hell tomorrow.
What does that mean?
It sounds funny, right? This is a piece of advice he received from a friend of his about 50 years ago, and he said it's still one of the best pieces of advice he's ever received. And I have to say, it's probably the piece of advice in getting there that I have passed on the most frequently. And what it means is really don't spout off in a moment of anger. If you do that, you might do something you regret. So Buffett says to hold on, wait for a day, And then you could tell them to go to hell tomorrow. You have not lost the opportunity.
That's right. You always have that opportunity the next day to say what you want, but just wait a day, let it cool down. It reminds me of a story of Abraham Lincoln, who used to write a lot of letters to congressmen and to others, but most of them he didn't mail. He would just put in a drawer and then forget about them. But it was this idea that he had the thought, he wrote the letter, but it didn't necessarily make any sense for him to actually act upon it. And I think it is somewhat in a similar vein. What else did Warren say about, you know, the way he thinks about his own life that caught your attention?
Well, one thing that I thought was really interesting is he also told me that the people you choose to associate with matters. So if you surround yourself with people who are better than you are, you're going to end up behaving more like them. And they in turn sort of will get it back from you. He says it's like a planetary system. But if you hang out with people who behave worse than you, you pretty soon will, you know, start being pulled in that direction. And so Warren, he really has an incredible group of friends. I think he lives by this. And, you know, I'm happiest when I go to his meetings or to his events, because it's just, you know, no matter who you talk to at one of those, you know it's going to be a pretty good quality person.
Absolutely. You know, talking about hanging out with people that are better than you or worse than you, one of the interviews in the book was with J. Craig Venter, and he was the inventor of being able to decipher the human genome. And he said in his story that he hung out with bikers early in his life. Tell us about that.
Well, he's a good example of somebody who had an unexpected, for what he turned out to be, he was the first person to sequence the human genome, and he is an incredible scientist and an incredible entrepreneur. But his history is pretty surprising, knowing who he is now. So I think that he's someone who made a huge change in his life from those beginnings. And that's inspiring to know, because you don't have to be born a certain way. You can evolve.
Well, he mentioned in his story that he barely passed high school. He got a D+. Only because they actually gave him an extra test, because he says, yeah, I don't think they really wanted to see my face anymore. So in order to get me out, they let him take a test. But even Bloomberg, who you interviewed, said he was a straight C student. So there seems to be a theme there that maybe it's not only about the grades. Maybe these people succeeded for other reasons. What do you take away from that?
Definitely. I think that the most common thread between my subjects is determination and resilience. They all have that. And I sort of imagine it like life is a game of whack-a-mole. Do you know that carnival game
where the moles? Yeah, you hit the mole down and another one pops up?
Exactly. They keep popping their heads up and your job is to whack them over the head. And I think life whacks us all over the head from time to time. I certainly saw that in my book. It can whack people in huge ways, and it can whack people in small ways, in personal ways, or ways that have to do with your business. And I think that everybody in my book is where they are today because they are super resilient and determined. And I think that, you know, the fact that a lot of them didn't do so well in school, didn't get in their way because they really were, you know, had a lot of resilience and determination.
One of the interviews was Matthew Weiner, who is the creator of Mad Men. And I'll tell you, from all the stories that I've read, I've never seen someone who really lost so much, who was unsuccessful to the degree to which he was unsuccessful. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Matthew Weiner, his TV show, Mad Men, it took 7 years from the time he wrote it till the time it finally made it on the screen. And during that time, it was rejected and rejected and rejected. He used to carry it around on him in case he ran into someone else who he hadn't pitched it to, who could maybe be helpful. But that's not the only, you know, rejection he received in his life. Earlier in his career, when he graduated from USC Film School, he couldn't get a job, and then he couldn't even get a meeting with an agent to help him get a job. So he spent 3 years writing spec scripts from home, which sort of evolved into him watching TV all day and lying to his wife about it. And eventually, he describes how he eventually got out of that rut and got on the track that he's on now.
Well, one of the statements that he made, which really got my attention because he had to work as a waiter. You have to have a job. You have to live if you're in the creative industry and you haven't, you know, succeeded. He says to get a second job, of course, but don't get too good at it. Don't become an expert in that second job, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that kind of goes back to the resilience. Like, if you're going to be successful at something, you can't give up. So you have to live in the real world. You have to have another job. But I think you wouldn't want somebody to get defeated by the wax life gives you and, you know, and give up on his or her dream.
In the book, there's a interview with Ian Schrager, who opened Studio 54, that incredibly famous nightclub, discotheque in New York City. And you talk about life, him making mistakes and getting whacked. I mean, he went to prison, didn't he?
He did. He opened Studio 54 and it became wildly successful and he was pretty young. And he sort of got intoxicated by that success and thought that the rules wouldn't apply to him. And he didn't pay his income taxes and got sent to prison for 13 months and he lost everything. He was close to $2 million in debt when he came out, but he was eventually able to reinvent himself as a real estate developer and a hotelier. Well, first of all, the whole episode set him back 10 years. So it wasn't just like he got out of prison and within a year he was doing the hotel business. It took him 10 years to get back to where he left off.
Mm-hmm.
But he says there's very little in life that you can't recover from. And he thinks he's proof that the prison system works. And he also talks about that same theme, that he says that in the end, there's little that separates people. Those who really want success the most and are relentless about pursuing it are the ones who get it.
The book is entitled Getting There, A Book of Mentors. Now, why did you call it The Book of Mentors?
Well, because I think that if you read it, it's sort of like having each subject talk to you like a mentor would. They give practical advice. They open up about their own experiences. They share whatever wisdom they have. And it's sort of like, you know, having a virtual mentor.
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
My guest is Jillian Zoe Siegel. She is the author of the book. Again, the book is Getting There, A Book of Mentors. One aspect of the book that struck me was the humaneness or the humanness of the interviews. It was as if I was having a beer with them or a glass of wine. And we were very relaxed and just sitting around. And so I applaud you on being able to get these kinds of people, you know, to that stage because, you know, they are on the public stage a lot. And I'm sure many of them have a public face and a private face. You really feel like you're listening to them in a private conversation. I was impressed with your interview with Bloomberg because he, again, did not start from any kind of advantage position and wasn't a great student. I think he said he was a straight C student. Take us through his life a little bit.
Well, he didn't do well in school in the beginning, but then I think, you know, when it was time to apply to business school, he took a double course load and really set his mind to it and got A's. But this was, you know, when he was already in college. But he started off by getting a job at Salomon Brothers. And he loved that job, and he was doing really well at it. But the thing is, after 15 years, they fired him. And, you know, if it happens to him, it can happen to anyone, right?
Yeah.
So what happened is nobody came rushing to give him another job. So he decided to start his own business, and that's how his company, Bloomberg, was born.
But he was incredibly tenacious. I mean, even taking it back before then, he would be the one to get into the office the earliest. He would leave the latest. And he even said, and this is for salespeople all around the world to listen to this, he would say that, you know, CEOs who were good CEOs were in before everyone else, and you could usually get them on the phone directly, and you didn't have to go through their gatekeepers. So he was thinking about that. Also, tell us the story about him roaming the halls with coffee and tea.
Well, first of all, he's an example of the fact that it doesn't just magically happen. This guy worked harder. You know, the stories that he told gave the phrase working hard a new meaning. Even after he was fired from Salomon Brothers, he said he still made sure to work 6 days a week from as early in the morning as he could till as late as he could. He was even looking for new office space for himself because he had gotten fired. And he told the broker that he could only look on the weekend because he didn't want anyone to ever say that he didn't work 110%. He had an ego problem with that. And I think that's the kind of ethic that got him reelected as mayor of New York City for 3 consecutive terms.
Right.
But when he was starting out, he wanted feedback on his new company. So he would show up at the coffee shop across from Merrill Lynch's headquarters at 6 in the morning, get a little tray with 2 coffees and 2 teas, one with milk, one without milk. And he would roam the halls and look for someone sitting alone reading their newspaper. And when he found someone, he would pop his head in with his tray of drinks and say, "Hi, I brought you coffee. Can I bend your ear?" And he figured no one was going to kick him out if he brought them coffee. If someone said they didn't drink coffee, he would say, "Well, then I have tea."
Mm-hmm.
So that's how determined he was. But I love that image of, you know, you can't think that you're above anything when you're starting your own business.
Earlier in the show, I mentioned this individual who had it very tough at the beginning as his brother committed suicide at age 23. He was 21 and he went into a tailspin. I was speaking about Anderson Cooper, who came from a very privileged family. He came from the Vanderbilt family. What can you tell me about things that he said?
Well, first of all, yeah, Anderson Cooper is someone, when people see his name in my book, they say, "Oh, he couldn't have had a hard time. He's from the Vanderbilt family," which is a very wealthy family. And it's true, his mother is Gloria Vanderbilt. But essay starts, "My father died during heart bypass surgery when I was 10 years old, and when I was 21, my 23-year-old brother committed suicide. He jumped off the terrace of our family's penthouse apartment as my mother pleaded for him to stay put." So he describes the tough time he had after that and how that affected him. And then when he graduated from college, he wanted to be a foreign news correspondent, but he couldn't even get an entry-level job at any of the major networks. So he ended up working at an agency that produced youth-oriented news programs for high schools. And he taught me something really interesting. He said that when you work at a company, people there tend to pigeonhole you in whatever role you happen to be in. And if you don't want to be in that role, you have to make your own opportunities. You have to do things for yourself. So he says that sometimes you have to do something drastic to change people's perception of you.
Right.
And what he did to launch his career was he quit his job. He went overseas to shoot stories by himself. He lived in roach-infested, cheap hotels, and he shot the stories that were as interesting and as dangerous as possible. Then he sold them back to this youth-oriented news company for such a low price that it was hard for them to refuse. And that is how he became the person we know him to be.
So it's differentiation, it's breaking out from the pack in order to reach that separate level of success. That's what it takes. And, you know, we're talking the full range, and we're not only talking about monetary success, because, I mean, obviously Warren Buffett, Michael Bloomberg are all billionaires, but we're talking about others who have made contributions in science, entertainment, and other areas as well. The book is Getting There, A Book of Mentors. My guest is Jillian Zoe Siegel, the author, and I highly recommend it. And if you read it for yourself, buy it for your kids, buy it for your grandkids, I think it'll really make a difference in their life. Jillian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, no T, stevepomerantz.com, and contact us one more time, stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Survey after survey shows that most Americans incorrectly think they're comfortably set for retirement. For example, a recent retirement confidence survey by the Employee Benefits Research Institute showed that 63% of workers are very or somewhat confident of having enough money for a comfortable post-career life. But the facts, such as the average 401k balance of less than $100,000 across the U.S., show us that reality is a lot more bleak and that many Americans have relatively little stashed away for retirement, and certainly not enough to give them a comfortable life down the road. So you have to wonder how accurate their self-assessment is. And as a financial planning professional, I believe a lot of people like to hide their heads in the sand on this one. It's like they just don't want to think about the harsh future that lies ahead and would on this one just rather delude themselves that they'll be fine in retirement than face reality. Now, I know it's hardly pleasant to be confronted with the truth that you're really behind on retirement savings, but rather you confront this now, grieve about the mistakes you've made, and get into rectifying your situation sooner rather than continue to bury your head in the sand on this really vital issue and pay the piper down the road. Even if you think you're doing a good job preparing for retirement, you may be fooling yourself. So I want you to go through this exercise with me. Let's start with five simple ways by which you can tell whether you're being realistic about your retirement planning efforts or simply deluding yourself and running up your risk. Number one, you don't do periodic retirement checkups. Saving regularly, ideally about 15% or so of your salary every year, is the cornerstone of any retirement strategy. But factor in inflation and rising healthcare costs, and you'll see that simply saving your money isn't good enough. You'll also need to make your savings grow so they beat inflation and compound your capital over time. And you want to ensure that you're actually making progress towards a secure retirement. So if you're someone who saves regularly but likes the safety of banks and CDs, think again. Let go of some of your risk aversion and take steps to get on track that grow your savings over time. Fortunately, there are lots of tools available for free on the internet that allow you to assess whether you're making sufficient headway. Talk to your bank or go to your brokerage firm's website and look at online retirement income calculators and make using them quarterly or half yearly a habit, where you plug in the information such as your salary and your percentage of savings and how your nest egg is divvied up between stocks and bonds and the age at which you plan to retire, and you get an estimate of the probability of achieving your financial goal. If you find your chances are slimmer than you'd like or that you've dropped from the last time you did the assessment, take action and see how saving more, investing differently, or changing your expected retirement date can improve your preparedness. Now, we've actually done a lot of work in this area, and we have identified or isolated those factors that are in your control and there where you can set your particular priorities to make sure that you keep your retirement plan on track. Now, if you're not confident that you could do this evaluation on your own, you can always consult an advisor, so please do this. It's actually quite easy once you do it, and you'll see that you could easily do it twice a year. But if you fail to perform this sort of exercise throughout your working life, you could find yourself closing in on your retirement date, woefully short of resources that you need to maintain your standard of living. Or maybe you lack a disciplined investment plan. You know, this one I address to a lot of you do-it-yourselfers out there, folks who like the stock market and like to manage their own finances. They want to save a buck on fees, but they truly lack investing discipline. You could be one of those folks. If you're an active trader in your retirement accounts, find yourself investing in funds that have topped the performance charts lately, or you, quote, diversify your portfolio, end quote, with new or arcane exchange-traded funds. Maybe you saw an article that sounded interesting to you and you picked one of those up. Or you try to time the market to avoid downturns and capitalize on rallies. In my experience, 99% of those who go it alone on their investments underperform the market and typically end up losing a sizable portion of their retirement savings on bad bets. And really, there is some data in this degree, and the data basically states that between 1996 and 2015, the S&P 500 was up over 8%, but the average investor was only up a little over 2%. That's not good. So be smart about that. If you're going to spend some money, Spend it where you can get some value and just don't be penny wise and pound foolish. All right. Also, you want to make sure that you have an effective approach to investing, building a diversified mix of stocks and bonds that match your appetite for risk. So you may say, well, what is my appetite for risk? You know, how do I know? Well, there are some online tools that can rate your appetite for risk relative to others. So you do a Google search on Risk Tolerance Asset Allocation Questionnaire. I know it's a mouthful. Risk Tolerance Asset Allocation Questionnaire. And you'll find tools from industry leaders such as Vanguard and Schwab and others, Fidelity and so on, that let you use them for free. And I'll be listing some of those on my website, which of course is stevepomerantz.com. No T in Pomerantz, stevepomerantz.com. Now on these sites, I also urge you to read up on recommended asset allocations that match your risk profile, and I advise against upping your risk beyond what these sites suggest your age, income, and savings profile. And now remember, though, that their suggestions are for the average person, and we're none of us individually are really average, so don't take them too literally. But they are, however, a great way to get started on understanding risk versus reward. Once you've evaluated your risk profile, invest as much as possible in funds with low fees, preferably index funds or ETFs that offer broad exposure to stock and bond markets, so less of your market returns go to the fund management company. Now, once you've created your retirement portfolio, resist the urge to tamper with it, even when the market is volatile. Instead, stick with the stock bonds blend you originally set. So, folks, the bottom line is that you want to get your head out of the sand. If you haven't really been doing this work, you think you have enough and you're not sure, you want to really think about the future. You don't want to be caught short later in life, realizing that you should have made those moves 5 or 10 years ago. To get more information about this topic, to ask us questions about this topic so we can share your questions and the answers of the questions with people on air, don't forget to come to our website and join our conversation at stevepomerantz.com. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.